Welcome to Grounded Wellness, your go-to podcast for simplified and trusted information on how to live a more non-toxic and holistic life. We're your hosts. I'm Bethany McDaniel, founder of Primally Pure, biohacking enthusiast and mom of three.
And I'm Courtney O'Connor, a holistic esthetician with over 15 years experience in the healing power of touch and holistic skincare rituals.
When it comes to women's hormone health, many symptoms are brushed off as normal, despite their significant impact on our overall well-being. That's why I'm so excited for today's conversation with Lisa Hendrickson-Jack, author of The Fifth Vital Sign, co-author of Real Foods for Fertility, and a leading expert in menstrual health. In this episode, we'll explore how understanding your menstrual cycle can help you live more in tune with your body and why it's time we rethink the way we view our periods. Let's dig in. Lisa, welcome to the Grounded Wellness Podcast. We're so grateful to have you on today's episode. Thanks for making the trek down from Canada.
Thank you so much for having me. This is so much fun.
So a lot of women discover Primally Pure on their journey to conceiving. And so I would love to jump right in on a topic just to help offer them support and hope and advice on this journey. So would love to hear, what are some of your top tips for fertility?
Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, coming from the background of cycle charting, I feel like especially when women are starting to conceive, there's so much confusion around when is the best time to try, am I ovulating? So I really feel like one of the first things that we should be focusing on is obviously learning to track our cycle. And I mean, the way that I teach it can be very involved. So without having to go all the way into the rabbit hole, I feel like even just learning about the role of your cervical fluid. So, you know, cervical fluid is, it can look like a clear stretchy fluid. It can look like creamy, white hand lotion. And for anybody who's not on contraceptives, you may have noticed that there's sometimes in the cycle that you feel kind of slippery or wet down there. You might notice something on your underwear. You might notice that there's times when you're wiping and, you know, the toilet paper just kind of slides. And so I think it's really helpful just as an intro to know that when you've, you know, after you've had your period and you start to see those types of observations, that is your fertile time. Mm-hmm. That's your fertile window. And when you're trying to conceive, the best time to try would be when you actually are observing that cervical fluid in the pre-ovulatory phase. And especially if you ever do observe that kind of clear, raw, egg white type cervical fluid. So just from that standpoint, I feel like that one piece of information is a really helpful place to start. Because, of course, we're all taught that the cycle is always 28 days, that ovulation always happens on day 14. So a lot of women are always kind of focused on that specific time frame and date. And depending on how your cycle unfolds, your fertile window could be earlier than that or later than that. And so for some women, they might be missing out on the opportunity. So I would say that's a very practical and useful standpoint, because what I always say is that the timing isn't everything. Because, you know, for some couples, they are timing correctly and it's still not happening. Mm-hmm. But without correct timing, you don't have anything. And that's why we can use fertility awareness as a method of birth control. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in terms of the fertility conversation, obviously, there's a lot more that you can do. I know Lily and I talk extensively about the role of nutrition as a way to really support your body through fertility. So I'm sure we'll get into that quite a bit. And there's a number of lifestyle factors to focus on. And I would also say that we want to focus also on the male partner. So there's a whole lot to that conversation, but just as a good place to start, I feel like just being aware of that, and then it's not all about you, we should also be applying some of those principles to your partner as well.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And we'll definitely dig into some of those nutritional tips and how to invite your partner into that process as well. And I know at Primally Pure, being a non-toxic skincare company, one of the things we often educate our community on is the reality of xenoestrogens in topical products and wanting to help minimize endocrine disrupting ingredients in personal care products. So if you don't mind touching on that even a little bit too, and how products we apply, or even period products, and how it can also impact fertility.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the really interesting things when you get into tracking your cycle is that you can kind of see, so if you were tracking, let's say, your cervical fluid, if you were tracking your basal body temperatures, you start to get like a lay of the land, and a healthy cycle tends to range somewhere between about 24 to 35 days with an average of about 29 days. And, you know, as you are in that pre-ovulatory phase, you would expect to see several days of mucus leading up to ovulation. After ovulation, you would expect a healthy luteal phase to be about 12 to 14 days. And so once you kind of have that general sense, then you can start to see if something is disrupting your hormone balance. Mm-hmm. And that could be specific observations that you're making, or it could even be certain symptoms that are cropping up at different times of the cycle. And so, you know, when you start to realize that almost all of the products that are not intentionally non-toxic contain toxic chemicals, a lot of people don't necessarily think of their skin as an organ. You know, anything you put on your skin, you should also be comfortable eating because it's basically the same, right? It's being absorbed into it. And so a lot of women, when they are tracking their cycles and they start to have certain concerns or different complaints, if they are then switching to non-toxic products, I mean, I've heard clients share experiences where maybe they were using menstrual products that were not organic. And so if you didn't know, you know, there's a lot of different chemicals in non-organic tampons and pads and things like that, who had, let's say, you know, period pain or different issues that they were experiencing. And some women find that just by switching, it goes away. Mm-hmm. So whether it's just balancing hormones in the more general sense or the more specific sense of noticing a significant impact in your hormonal balance. And then as it pertains to fertility, I mean, we have a whole chapter on toxins and how that can have a negative effect on follicular development, sperm development. Mm-hmm. So it's really important. And one last thing I'll say on that topic is, you know, I remember before I had my first son and working with clients like who are trying to get pregnant, but they're not pregnant yet. One of the questions I often ask is, you know, would you still be using this same product if you were pregnant now? Or would you use this product on your infant? So when you become a mom, I know for me, I went out and bought all this, you know, got different laundry detergent. And so the question would be, well, why are you still using it?
Oh, yeah. I feel like so many women especially find Primally Pure once they find out they're pregnant, because it's like no longer just about you, but it's about this little life, when even in that preconception phase, like starting to make those changes even before the little one is there is so important.
Well, of course. And I mean, if you think about it, part of the benefit of reducing your exposure to these toxic chemicals is that now your body doesn't have the additional burden of mm-hmm. having to remove it. And it allows your body's natural detoxification processes to be even more effective. Mm-hmm. You know, because if you're constantly bombarding yourself with all of these different products, your liver is having to kind of do that. And your liver is busy. Your liver is always working. So if you're giving it all this extra work to do, there's other things that are also important that may not be happening. So very important in terms of balancing hormones and optimizing fertility.
Do you have any helpful tips to help mitigate the negative effects of toxins in fertility and preconception health?
I mean, I think the first step is awareness, as I'm sure you appreciate. You have to actually learn about the stuff that's in your products. You have to start to understand that even though it's really nice to smell like strawberries, whenever you have products that have these artificial fragrance, you really have to start to be aware of that. So in terms of, you know, to how to mitigate, once you're aware, then you can start to reduce. And the awareness piece can be really overwhelming, because you can really go down a rabbit hole with it. Mm-hmm. It's all of the things you put on your skin. It's all the things you use to wash your clothes. It could even be off-gassing in your carpets. It could be the stuff that comes off your mattress. It's the pots, the nonstick pans. So if you really go there, it can feel very overwhelming. So, you know, once you become aware, then we have to kind of like calm down and start to think of practical ways to do it. So for a lot of my clients, it's, now that you're aware, as you run out of these products, you know, once you reach the end of the bottle, you look for a natural alternative. You look for natural skincare brands. You look for natural cleaners and those types of things. And like little by little, you can sort it out. And just to give a little bit of context, you know, it's been a while, but I've gone through this process myself. And it took years. And some of the last things that I was doing recently would be the whole house water filter. Like that wasn't the first thing that I did, right? Because there's another thing, right? Your water. But, you know, you kind of gradually make these changes and don't expect, I mean, some people are super type A. If you want to do it all in a month, good luck. But I think the rest of us typically take some time to sort it out.
I love that. We do as well try to make it more digestible and sustainable and practical, because it can be so easy to feel overwhelmed by all these changes that need to be made. So where would you recommend would be the best place to start if someone has been wanting to conceive or feeling discouraged or overwhelmed by all this awareness that they're gaining? What do you have, like, start here?
Well, I think one thing I usually say when we get into this conversation is kind of like the number one endocrine disrupting thing that no one ever just mentions in the conversation would be hormonal contraceptives. So certainly, you know, if you think about it, you know, even though your lotion contains these xenoestrogens products, like unless you brought it from primarily pure, right? It wasn't designed specifically to stop you from ovulating, which the pill was. So I think, you know, there's that. But beyond that, I think just start to be aware of the things that you use every day. Mm-hmm. So scented stuff. You know, still to this day, you go and visit friends and you get in an Uber and you're just blasted by this stuff. And so raising the awareness of those kinds of things, I would say the stuff that you use every day, the things you use to wash with, your laundry detergent, you know, stuff that's going to go on your sheets, just start there, your skincare products, because again, you're putting it on all over everywhere. So I think that would be the first place. And then gradually start to look it up. Like, there's so much more I could say. We could also talk about how you store your food and reducing plastic exposure. And like, there's so much, but I would just say pick one thing and start there.
It's perfect. Thank you so much for that helpful insight. It's so great. And so as a mama of three, I would love to hear too how you prepared for your pregnancies through this fertility awareness and cycle tracking.
Mm-hmm. Well, so as you mentioned, I have three children. My eldest is 12 and then my middle is 9 and my baby is 2. So I would certainly say that I certainly learned along the way, and there was much that I didn't know when I was pregnant with my first. But ultimately I have been tracking my cycle for over 2 decades. And so, I mean, that piece of it was so ingrained that I was able to take it for granted. So what I mean by that is in my 20s, I was tracking my cycle to avoid pregnancy. And so in that respect, when I was ready to conceive, my husband and I would just like do it on the days we weren't doing it before, right? Mm-hmm. So that part of it was really reassuring. And I think what was really helpful about that is when you do track, you do know quite soon, you know, if you're pregnant. And so, you know, that aspect of it, I don't know that there was much preparation with regards to the fertility awareness piece, because I already had that education knowledge. But in terms of preparation, there was a lot of things that we did. I mean, of course, the way that we eat and prioritizing a lot of the foods that Lily and I talk about in Real Food for Fertility. So, you know, we talk a lot about organ meats. We talk a lot about fish and seafood. So, I mean, organ meats are really nutrient dense. There's just, you know, iron, vitamin A, B vitamins, choline. It's such a rich, it's almost one of the ways to think about liver, for example, is nature's multivitamin. Mm-hmm. You know, if you ever wondered, 200 years ago, they didn't have vitamins. So what were people doing, right? They were eating these nutrient dense foods. Fish and seafood are great sources of, you know, zinc and vitamin B12. And, you know, obviously the omega-3 fatty acids that really play a role in supporting egg and sperm quality. So there's a lot of just, it's not to say that I wouldn't want to give the impression that my diet is so perfect. I mean, but at the same time, we always emphasize these key foods. And the approach that I think that we take is you want to incorporate as many of those as possible. Full fat dairy products, I've been getting my raw milk for, you know, I started to get it when my second was born. So almost 10 years, this would be 10 years since we've had that. And one of the things that I think is really important is that, you know, even when we were preparing for our second baby, I mean, I don't know that I was so on my husband or anything, but he really took he took steps to reduce his alcohol consumption. And so I think a big piece of it too is for both of you to do this together. Mm-hmm. And it's often, not all of the time, but sometimes if you as the woman are cooking these foods, often he's just eating them as well. So sometimes it's really easy. But I think, you know, for us, that was a huge part of what we did. And obviously we were really intentional given how deep we are into this work. So for my second child, we started eating this way a year before we started trying. And similarly with Isabella, because it's part of how we eat all the time anyways, but we just kind of ramped it up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Would you mind, on that note, speaking more about nutrition's impact on the sperm and egg quality?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what's really interesting when you dive into the research about how the sperm develops and how the egg develops. So for women, you know, we're born with all the eggs that we ever have. So when we're born, we have anywhere from, you know, 500,000 to 1,000,000 eggs. And then over time, that number kind of gradually declines. So the eggs are there, but they're not ready to go. So there's a process of follicular development that takes place. And the research is interesting because kind of the most significant, you know, part of that development takes place during about that 3 month, you know, 3 to 6 months prior to when you're actually ovulating that specific egg. Though that developmental process, you know, some of the studies suggest that it starts even 7-8 months before that. But that kind of most significant period of time that this follicle is most susceptible to those nutrient inputs would be that kind of 3 to 6 month period. So in terms of the, you know, and with sperm quality as well, so the research tells us that it takes about 74 days for the sperm to develop and to mature. So one way to think about that is if your partner were to ejaculate today, that sperm is going to be a result of whatever was happening 3 months prior. Mm-hmm. So like when this is released, look at your calendar, look 3 months prior and think to yourself, what was I doing at that point? And that is really the largest contributor to the egg and sperm quality. So mm-hmm. with that in mind, I mean, one of the reasons that we really focus on this concept of like preconception nutrition and taking time before, in a perfect world, ideal, if you have the time, you know, at least 3 to 6 months of focused nutrition is how we're really going to support egg and sperm quality. And in terms of how that plays out, I mean, when these follicles are developing, if you, you know, one of the challenges with that is commonly talked about as women get older would be the increased rate of chromosomal abnormalities or DNA issues or things like that. And we can have some control over that by focusing on nutrient dense foods, focusing on antioxidant foods to really minimize the effects and support the optimal development, the optimal chromosomal splitting that has to happen in order. And it's really a miracle. If you think about everything that has to go right for this. And so it's just really essential. And it's specifically in that kind of 3 to 6 month period leading up to it.
So fascinating. And it's, I feel like that's quite empowering too, because it's like, it's also not like decades that have led to that. So it's like, okay, we can still make these changes now and see that benefit and that positive impact in the near future. So on that topic of nutrition as well, love that you brought in the organ meats and more of that ancestral way of eating, which is something we educate a lot about at Primally Pure. So I would love to also kind of look at some maybe fertility myths versus your perspective on fertility and really how to optimize that, and looking at some of maybe the more popular diets, even maybe touching on vegetarianism or veganism, and then even what are some like conventional nutritional advice that's given that may not actually be as effective.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like there's a lot of nutritional recommendations and research that we share in Real Food for Fertility that differs from the guidelines in a lot of different ways. I mean, one of those recommendations, for example, would be the protein, the focus on protein. So, you know, in the book, we talk extensively about protein and the role it plays in follicular development and in normalizing the menstrual cycle, even in ensuring that our bodies are the correct temperature, even in thermogenesis. And so, you know, the recommended daily allowance for a lot of nutrients and for protein and for a lot of things, it wasn't really designed to represent what would be optimal for fertility. Mm-hmm. So some of the research that we share would indicate that, you know, the ideal protein intake is anywhere from 1.5 to, you know, 2.2 grams per kilo of body weight, which is significantly higher than the RDA. And I think one of the great things about the approach of looking at the menstrual cycle, charting, and actually seeing what's happening. So, of course, I teach charting in a specialized way so that you can really get a sense of what's going on. You kind of get into the nitty-gritty, the mucus and the temperature, and that gives you, essentially a kind of a reflection of what's happening hormonally. Mm-hmm. So, you know, with the protein recommendations, there's a lot of different thoughts on that. And so, you know, there's some people that would be in alignment with that recommendation. It's certainly in alignment with the recommendation for women who are athletic, because obviously the recommendation would be higher. And there would be some who might say, oh, well, that's like too high or whatever. But ultimately, if you look at what's happening in the cycle, what we've seen is that, you know, if I'm working with somebody and they're, you know, struggling with progesterone issues, which tend to show up in the cycle as a short luteal phase or even premenstrual spotting or low body temperature, or maybe their cervical mucus is really scant, indicating that maybe their estrogen levels aren't optimal to be actually stimulating that cervical mucus production. You know, when you add sufficient protein, when you add sufficient fat, I mean, it's so interesting that the fat conversation is so controversial, because we know that our, you know, ovarian hormones, estrogen, progesterone, testosterone are literally synthesized from cholesterol. So it's interesting that we have to have this conversation, and that there's so much controversy about including sufficient fat. But again, when you look at how the cycle responds to incorporating sufficient protein and fat and high quality carbohydrates, you see for yourself that it really allows women to produce enough hormones to for their body temperature to get in alignment, for their luteal phase to be long enough and often, for some of those PMS symptoms to reduce. And so that would be, you know, I'm touching on kind of the myths around protein and fat. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned some of the controversial dietary things. I mean, there's so many diets. Mm-hmm. And certainly there's a camp out there that would say that a vegetarian or vegan diet would be optimal for fertility. However, I would argue that the research wouldn't, I don't think the research matches. There's some really interesting research that Lily pulls into chapter 2 of Real Food for Fertility, and really going into not only the concept of protein, just full stop, but the quality of protein as well. And so there is research to suggest that, you know, incorporating animal protein specifically can have a unique positive impact, whether that's, you know, there was an interesting study that she shared where they were looking at PMS symptoms among women, and based on the differences between their protein intake, and the women who were consuming the animal protein had fewer symptoms. And so there's different research that would indicate that, you know, there is, we need to have a conversation about animal protein and how beneficial it is. And then we have to look at the menstrual cycle as the evidence. So what I can say, just what I've seen over the years working with lots of women looking at menstrual cycles, is that, you know, when we're really limiting all animal products, like no animal products at all, so if we're going more on the vegan end, it seems like there's often a limit to where we can get to if we're trying to optimize hormone balance. Mm. So it's almost like you have to kind of go into it. And again, looking at the menstrual cycle, looking at optimizing hormonal balance, looking at optimizing luteal phase function, there just seems to be a limit. And often when women are starting to incorporate those animal foods, we see incredible shifts. Mm. So again, it's not about take my word for it. It's about look to see what the research has to say. And then also look at how the cycle responds. And that is really going to be the true test of all of this.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I love that you keep going back to the cycle and letting that speak to you. Obviously, your first book, The Fifth Vital Sign, and how it really is that marker of health. And so really tuning into our bodies and looking at the messages it's sending us. So I think that's really valuable, like making these changes and then tuning in to see how you're seeing that impact overall. Mm-hmm. And so we've obviously spoken a lot on the female perspective for fertility. And so I would love for you to speak to how can we also focus on the male side of things and inviting our men into this conversation. It's not just solely based on women's bodies, but obviously optimizing fertility for men as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you had asked about different fertility myths. And I feel like one of the myths, if we want to call it that, is that the fertility issue is a woman's issue. And if there's something happening, if conception is delayed or if you're struggling to conceive, that it must be an issue on her side. Yeah. And so, again, when we look at the stats, 30% of fertility issues are solely related to male infertility. And then up to 50% of the time. So half of the time, if there is a fertility issue, there's at least a male contributing factor. Mm. And I mean, it's so interesting because if you think about it, I mean, he's contributing 50% of the genetic material. And there's just so much interesting research about how important his contribution is. So there's research to suggest that, you know, if his sperm is of poor quality or if there's DNA damage or, you know, other various chromosomal developmental issues, that it can negatively impact the development of your placenta. Mm. And there's, you know, even research that talks about the quality of his sperm having an impact on your child's likelihood of developing certain childhood diseases. So I feel like in terms of bringing your partner into the conversation, we just have to first start to raise that awareness. And as soon as you say it, it's like, oh yeah, that makes, mm-hmm. that makes perfect sense, right? Another thing that I'll say about it is that after working with a lot of different women who are trying to conceive, when I do have clients whose partners have been tested, their results have been tested, they're often, like almost 100% of the time, told that his results are fine. And so that's a big topic that we tackle in Real Food for Fertility. We have this really extensive sperm chapter. There was a time when I wanted to write a book about sperm. So instead of that, we wrote this chapter. So it's kind of like full, jam-packed, full of information. But that's one of my biggest pet peeves, because basically we have the sperm guidelines that were set in 2010 by the World Health Organization. And, you know, it's really interesting to look at the study that was the foundation and basis for that recommendation. And so, you know, they took approximately 2,000 couples who were trying to conceive, and they were testing their sperm quality, like the male sperm quality. And so, you know, they had all these couples trying to conceive. And so all of the couples that were successfully able to conceive within 1 year, they measured all of the sperm qualities of the men. And so if you look at the study, they put them on a graph and they organized them by centile. And so if you're looking at the graph, you know, like back to math class, you have like the fifth centile, 10th, 25th, 97th or whatever. So now you have the picture in your mind. And in order to set those guidelines, they took the lower fifth centile, and that is what represents normal, according to the World Health Organization guidelines. Mm. So it's really interesting because when I pull out the study, you know, in a session and I show the client, they're always like, what do you mean? Why? Mm. And so I think that when you're setting a standard guideline, they would have different requirements for public health than we might for looking at what would be optimal. Mm-hmm. So the first thing to understand is that those guidelines were never set to be optimal.
Wow.
And so they were set for a different reason. And I think they have to make these decisions because if they're setting it at a certain point, it means that if a person is lower than that, they're going to, you know, recommend medical attention. And I think there's some concern maybe on their part that if they put it too high, there'll be too many false positives. We also talk a little bit about how those guidelines have changed. So there have been, I think, 4 or 5 different iterations of those guidelines. And so in 2010, it was like they made it a little bit lower than it had been before. So the implications of that are that there were men that previously would have been identified for screening, but now are not. Mm-hmm. But all this is to say that, you know, for women who've been trying to conceive, and if their partner was tested and they were told that they were fine, what we argue for, you know, in Real Food for Fertility is that you have this lower guideline that is not optimal. And then if you look at studies that are trying to determine what is actually optimal, they're going to ask a different question. So there was this one study, and essentially they were looking at, okay, at what point is the negative sperm quality starting to have a negative impact on time to pregnancy? So that's a very different question, because they're trying to say, you know, if you think about it, after a certain point, if he has like 600 million sperm, is it really helping you to get pregnant faster? Like, there's probably a point where it doesn't have an impact. And so they identified a specific marker of when it starts to have a negative impact. And so their marker was about 48 million sperm per milliliter, like in terms of the concentration, about 12% normal morphology, so the sperm that actually just looks normal, and about 63% motility. So that was what they identified as, like, below this, we start to see a reduction or like an increased time to pregnancy. And the World Health Organization identifies 15 million sperm per milliliter, and they identify 40% motility. And you, these words, like, you just say the words, oh, motility, whatever. it means the sperm that are moving. Mm-hmm. And so it's like 60% aren't moving. And then the morphology that they list is 4%. And so again, 4% means out of 100, 4 have a normal appearance and 96 have an abnormal appearance.
Wow.
So basically you have these low parameters that the world, so if you had a test and your partner was told he's fine, he meets those guidelines. And we have what this study identified to be optimal. And so in the middle, we have this gray area. And that's what we're trying to point out. Like, that's the whole point of this, all what I just said. We want to be aware that there's this gray area mm-hmm. where it doesn't mean your partner is not fertile. You could get pregnant, but the implications of his sperm being less optimal are that it could take you longer. So that's where the nutritional components come in. That's where these strategies come in. That's where that time frame of a minimum of 3 to 6 months come in, because your partner could be fine, but like, we're talking about your children here. No one wants fine. We want optimal. We want the best possible health for our children. And so armed with this information, we can actually make a huge difference. And it's wild. Like, you know, I've had the pleasure of seeing clients kind of follow through with a lot of these things, do the sperm test initially or have that initial amount, work at this for several months. And the one great thing about sperm that is different from egg quality, we can't just go and take an egg sample, you know, is that you can actually see the positive improvements, and it can be very exciting. And it obviously then can improve your chances of conception mm-hmm. as well.
Fascinating. I know I appreciate all the research and the background and just all that detail. I know our community does as well. So thank you for just unpacking all of that more. So would the ways to optimize male fertility be essentially the same for women in those product and lifestyle swaps and incorporating more animal-based proteins? And
yeah.
Or is there anything different than that men should be focusing on?
Well, I think overall, there are definitely these kind of foundational tenets mm-hmm. that apply to both parties. So obviously increasing the quality of the foods that you're consuming. You know, we called the book Real Food for Fertility. I mean, it's obviously part of Lily's series, Real Food. But if you think about what does it mean, real food, it means food that is as close to natural as possible. So obviously, you know, we're not purists to the point that you can never buy anything in a package, but just to have that concept of, you know, what does it mean to have processed food or highly processed food, and how does that affect the quality of the food? So if you have, you know, flour or sugar, for example, you could put it out on the table and we wouldn't be able to tell what grade it came from, or the sugar, like what plant it came from, because it's so highly processed. So you can think about that when you're trying to think about what is real food. If you know what it is, you can look at it and you can understand where it came from. You know, starting with that aspect, looking at the quality of your food, and then starting to incorporate. So I would say, you know, that's part of the foundational aspect of it, incorporating some of the foods that we've talked about that are highly nutrient dense, of course, for both male and female fertility, play a really important role. And I think some of the unique aspects that men can focus on, you know, often when I think about improving male fertility, I feel like I always think about this analogy of like, you know, what if you're driving a car, you know, you have the gas and you have the brakes. So the brake would be, you know, smoking all the pot, the marijuana products, it'd be smoking cigarettes. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that that has a negative impact on sperm quality. There is evidence to suggest that, you know, saunaing or hot tubbing, like having the testicles hot a lot, has a negative impact. So there are specific things we want to look at for men. And those would be my example of like taking your foot off the brake. Because sometimes when you have a really poor sperm quality test, sometimes there are very specific kind of red flags that are like, oh, well, maybe if we improve this habit, then that would improve it. And then in terms of putting your foot on the gas, that comes in terms of the diet and really prioritizing key nutrients. So we know that vitamin A plays a really crucial role in sperm production, to the point that there are research studies that have looked at kind of interfering with vitamin A metabolism in men as a contraceptive. So, So there's animal studies that would indicate that vitamin A is like the on and off switch. So that's where like the liver or the cod liver oil kind of piece comes in. You know, folate plays a key role in sperm development. Zinc plays a key role. Vitamin D in both male, like, and all of these nutrients play a key role in both male mm-hmm. and female fertility as well. So just really prioritizing that, I think, on both sides And I mean, I could go on, but I'll kind of pause there.
So helpful. I think it's great too, just to give these practical pieces of input for both parties. And I mean, it takes two to tango. And so empowering both the woman and the man and taking those proactive choices to optimize, as you said, optimize. So circling back to the pill, which you mentioned is one of the first places to start for a woman who is in that process of wanting to conceive, when would you suggest having it removed or stopping taking the pill in preparation for pregnancy?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like with that question, this is something I could talk on for for such a long time. I think the first thing I'll say is that there's not necessarily one answer for everyone because there's a couple different situations. But in terms of the pill, I think what I like to do is I like to actually go to the research, because what can happen is when you learn about some of the negative aspects of hormonal birth control, so especially the conversation about the side effects and how it can have a negative impact on mood and on sex drive and nutrient deficiencies. I mean, we know that it's associated with causing deficiency of B vitamins like folate and B2, like these are the vitamins that we need in order to have a healthy pregnancy. So there are some kind of general aspects of it that everyone should be aware of. And I think the most important message that I like to share about the pill is that, you know, there's no evidence to suggest that the pill has a permanent negative impact on fertility. So I feel like that's good news. So although I'm very critical about the pill, I don't want to be kind of overstating this issue. But with that said, there is enough information in the research to show that it does create this temporary negative effect, this temporary subfertility when a woman comes off the pill. And that's certainly exacerbated by long-term use. And the research typically defines long-term as 2 or more years, which is interesting because when I say that, people are always like, what? Because a lot of women are using the pill for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. I had a client who used it for 30, right? So so that's something to consider. So what we can learn from the research, and this is a whole topic. There was this paper that recently came out, recently, like 2024, and it was this whole, I feel like it was this whole damage control thing, because they were kind of, you know, all of these health influencers have been, you know, talking negatively about the pill. And so we're here to set the record straight. And so they kind of like glazed over a lot of the issues to try to minimize them. But when we look at the research, one of the ways to look at how the pill impacts fertility is to look at the time to pregnancy studies. Mm-hmm. And those are studies that have women who are on contraception, and then they come off and they kind of compare them to women who hadn't taken contraception and see like how long is it taking them to conceive. And so I take issue with some of these studies because they're often presented in a very specific way. So most of these time to pregnancy studies, basically they take these women off the pill and then at the year mark, they look at how many of them got pregnant. And then they say, oh, you know, 80-something% got pregnant in a year. So it's good. We're like, it's fine. It's the same as regular, you know, conception rates. So we're good to go. But when you look a little bit deeper, those studies exclude anybody who had any type of cycle issues. So if you had irregular cycles, if you were put on the pill for period pain, if you were put on the pill because you had, I don't know, like you didn't have a cycle at all, you're not included in the study. Mm-hmm. And we know that there's a lot of non-contraceptive reasons that women are being put on the mm-hmm. pill. So first of all, if you were on the pill legitimately to, quote, regulate your cycle, which we could talk about, then that study doesn't apply to you. Furthermore, those studies look at the 12-month mark, period, end, full stop. They don't look at, well, how many months? Like, was there, like, did they conceive in month 2 or did they conceive in month 6 or did they conceive in month 9? And these are very important questions because of what literally happens when women come off the pill. So when you have lived your whole life under the lie that we can get pregnant every day and under the immense fear of an impending pregnancy, and you've basically spent your whole life like trying to avoid pregnancy, right, at all costs, you're under the impression that when you come off the pill, you're going to get pregnant immediately. And so by month, maybe month 1 or 2, you might be like, okay, but by month 3, you're already freaking out. Mm-hmm. By month 6, you're at the fertility clinic. Mm-hmm. And by month 12, you might have already done some procedure. Like this is how this plays out for women. So one of the studies that I shared, I think I shared it in both books, was the study where they actually broke it down month to month. And so they had women who had used condoms. They had women who had used like the regular kind of combined synthetic estrogen progestin pill. They had women who came off the hormonal IUD. And they had women who also used the shot and the implant. And when they broke it down month to month, the women who had stopped using condoms, so non-hormonal methods, like their cycles didn't need to go through any type of transition. 4 months was the average time to conception. The combined pill, 8 months. So double the time, average time to conception. The shot, 18 months, which, I mean, the shot is not my favorite. It certainly does have the kind of longest, most significant suppressive effect on ovulation. But that study is very telling because in that study, it took the women who were on the pill twice as long on average to conceive. Now, of course, some women get off the pill and they conceive immediately and some women don't. But that's one of the studies that shows that there is this temporary suppressive effect. And I would say that some of the scary stats, there's a couple scary stats that I've shared, like the stats that kind of make people the most nervous. And so one of those is the effect of the pill on ovarian reserve parameters. And so women who are on the pill across the board have lower ovarian reserve parameters. And that includes ovarian volume and includes AMH levels, anti-Müllerian hormone, and antral follicle count. And I mean, if you think about it logically, well, of course it does, because what does the pill do? So different formulations and different hormonal contraceptives have different, you know, modes of action. But generally speaking, like if we're talking about just the combined synthetic estrogen progestin, and I always make a point of saying it because it's not the same estrogen, right? But the primary mode of action of those is to suppress ovulation. And that's why they work. So this is part of the strategy. And they do that by interfering with the hypothalamic pituitary ovarian communication that's happening. So they shut down ovarian function. So then logically, if we're just stopping that function, then they're not in use. So it does make sense that those ovarian parameters, ovarian reserve parameters are suppressed. So the scary stat is that the ovarian volume in women on the pill has been shown to be, you know, up to 50% less,
wow,
meaning that the, like, it shrinks, like, right? Like, that's why it's the scary stat. So, you know, again, that information, when you look at the studies that are looking at this, there's no research to indicate that those changes are permanent. So, of course, when you bring it up, people are like, oh my gosh, shrinking the ovaries. But again, so there was a really interesting study that looked at this, and it was a fertility preservation study. So sometimes when you want to find out the research, you have to go to where the money is. Mm-hmm. So, of course, fertility preservation is when you have a woman who is, you know, concerned about her future fertility, and she's trying to either save egg follicles, or she's trying to save embryos. And so what they were finding was that women who were doing this, if they just stopped taking contraceptives and immediately go in for the procedure, they weren't getting as good of a yield. And so they did the study to see, okay, well, if you come off the pill and just do it right away versus if you wait, then is it going to improve? And so in those studies, they saw that if you waited 6 to 7 months or more, the AMH values would improve, the overall parameters would improve, and the oocyte yield was better too. So then what do you think the researchers suggested? They said, oh, well, if you're doing fertility preservation, then it would be a really good idea to wait. You know, come off the pill about 6 to 7 months before you want to do the procedure and you'll get a better yield. So just think about this for a minute. You know, why doesn't that advice carry over for women who are trying to conceive naturally, right? So this is the longest answer to your question, right?
The long answer.
Right? Like, but ultimately, you know, the first part of the answer would be, okay, so now we understand that there is this temporary period of subfertility post-pill. It doesn't mean that you can't get pregnant. But it's like, I have insurance for my car. I don't expect to get into an accident, but I know I could. So I have this insurance so that I'm prepared if I do. And so I feel like the approach that we should take when we're thinking about when to come off contraception is to be aware that there's this temporary period of subfertility so that we can plan ahead, because nobody tells you this. Mm-hmm. The amount of women that I've spoken to who, you know, I'm getting married in the fall, or my partner and I are planning to get pregnant next year. So I made an appointment with my doctor to ask if I should come off the pill. And I'm always like, okay, so you like put on your clothes, like you took a shower that morning, you put on your clothes, you drove across town to have your doctor tell you, like, no, you don't need to come off early. If you come off now, you'll just get pregnant right away. Don't worry about it. You can just, and this is like the standard thing I've heard over and over again, but there was something inside of you that caused you to ask that question, right? Because there was something that was like, maybe I should give myself a little bit of a break. Mm. So I really think that since no one is talking about this, we have to go to the research. And so minimum, I would say 6 months, but, you know, ideally, I feel like 12 months should be the minimum, but that's my perspective on it. And the second part of it is that, you know, if you were put on the pill for a specific issue, if you know that you didn't have regular cycles, if you know your period pain was super extreme, if you know that you weren't cycling at all, then I would say 18 months to 2 years. And that means coming off the pill when you're not trying to get pregnant, like when you're still actively avoiding, finding another alternative so that you can actively prevent pregnancy until you're ready, but giving your body time to normalize and also taking the time to just to see the lay of the land. Like maybe you've been on the pill for 8 years, maybe you've been on for 10. You don't even know what your normal cycle is like. Mm-hmm. You know, this would give you an opportunity to track your cycle and start to see what's going on, observe your cycle, go through that transition period without the added stress of also trying to conceive at the same time.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And I think too, then kind of moving into, obviously the pill is often prescribed to not balance these symptoms, but more to mask them. And there's so many symptoms of our period and our menstrual cycle that leads to that prescription. And so I would love to kind of turn the conversation into that perspective now. And so looking at how can we begin to reframe our periods, especially for women who are suffering with these more severe symptoms, like you've just mentioned, and how do we optimize our health instead of just enduring those symptoms and that discomfort or masking it with the pill?
Mm-hmm. It's such an important conversation. I think one of the ways is to start recognizing that your cycle and your period, it's not only important when you're trying to get pregnant. Mm-hmm. I think we have to start understanding that if you're a woman of reproductive age, your cycle is a part of the whole picture. And essentially, you know, this is why I titled my first book, The Fit Vital Sign, because it is, that's exactly what it is. So, you know, a vital sign, some of the most common that we're familiar with would be like your blood pressure or your heart rate or your respiratory rate. And so we all know that if your doctor measures your blood pressure, that there is a normal range. And if it's too high or if it's too low, it also provides a doctor with some idea of what could be causing it to be too high. Mm-hmm. So I think the first thing is to have a different understanding of our cycle as when we think of it in this light, then instead of thinking it's separate from yourself and it's just problematic for no reason, you start to understand that if your cycle is really off, if you are having irregular cycles, or if you do have really intense pain, that's your body's way of trying to communicate with you. I mean, your body can't like email you, right? So it can't communicate with you in that way. So your body communicates with you through symptoms. And when we start to understand that those imbalances are a reflection of what's happening, mm-hmm. that's the first step. And then the second step is to learn about what are the things that we can do to support hormonal balance so that we can bring it back. I think that's one of the challenges is that, you know, when you're at the beginning of this journey, until you start kind of diving into the rabbit hole and learning more about it and finding resources to really support your body's natural function, you might just feel like, well, this is always going to be this way. There's nothing I can do. And many of us have been told that. I mean, you might go to your doctor and you say, look, I'm only ovulating. Like when I was, I had a photo shoot. This has been a busy week. I had a photo shoot this week. And so I went to MAC to get lipstick. And so, you know, what do you do? Right. I'm talking to the girl at the counter and she tells me that she gets her period once or twice a year. And, you know, and this happens to me all the time because everywhere, if someone asks me what I do, right? So this is like one of a gazillion times this happened. But basically, you know, this is my issue. I went to the doctor and they were just like, go on the pill. And she's like, I didn't want to go on the pill because, you know, I feel like there's actually something wrong. And so this is a part of the conversation we have to shift. So many women have had that experience where they know that there's something wrong and they're just being told to go on the pill. But what the pill does is the pill, we talked about it, it suppresses ovulatory function. And so I like to teach with analogies. So I often share this analogy. So, you know, if I had like a summer house, which would be so fun, and, you know, I go up there and, you know, there's like water all over the place because I have a leaky pipe or like my pipe burst or whatever the case. So the pill is like this situation where I just shut off the water. I didn't actually fix the pipe though. So I shut off the water. I get the people in to help with the water remediation or whatever. And then I go back home, and the following summer, I go back up there. Well, what happens if I turn on the pipe, if I didn't fix the pipe? So I feel like, yeah, the first step is to start to understand that the cycle is actually part of us. It's reflecting what's happening health-wise. And like you said, the pill just is masking these issues. And one of the challenges is that some of the issues that show up in the menstrual cycle can imply really significant things. So for example, if somebody is not cycling at all. So a woman of reproductive age, she used to have her cycle and she just doesn't have a period for 6 months or more. Often that's, you know, caused by hypothalamic amenorrhea, which is characterized by undernutrition, overexercise and stress, like a combination of those. So basically you're not getting even enough nutrition to ovulate, like to support normal hormone function. And if a woman has that condition and it goes on for a long period of time, I mean, she can develop early onset osteoporosis. Like, this is a serious issue. And so when we go to the doctor and they put us on the pill as a first port of call, that like, that is not, like, I don't think that's the appropriate response. I feel like we should be assessing her dietary intake. We should be looking at this more significantly because she could bring her period back through a process of nutrition and, you know, identifying what's happening with her exercise, looking at her stress, looking at all of these factors, and then she doesn't have to develop osteoporosis. Or we could put her on the pill and just ignore it. And then what does she do later on if she wants to get pregnant?
Mm-hmm. Wow. I think that's so fascinating as well, because it invites in that long-term perspective. I think so often we're just in that short-term temporary mindset of those quick fixes, really. And often we educate a lot on holistic health and healing, and really it's been months or years that have contributed to these imbalances. It's going to take time to restore them. And so looking at some of these imbalances within the body, what would you say then are actually markers of health, looking at the menstrual cycle, and what are signs of a healthy cycle?
Yeah, I mean, I alluded to a few of them. So I mentioned that a healthy cycle, typically somewhere between 24 to 35 days, average of about 29 days. So I think it's helpful to note that the cycle doesn't always have to be exactly 28 days for it to be healthy. If I take you through the different phases of the cycle, so if we start with the period, the first day of your true flow would be the first day of your period, the first day of your cycle. And, you know, a healthy period typically is averaging about 4 to 5 days. And we would expect it to start kind of moderate to heavy and then, you know, gradually taper off. So there can be some changes in flow, but, you know, you would expect, I usually say the period should be like a sentence. It should have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and then it should be over. And so if you're having bleeding that's going on for days or weeks, if you're having kind of bleeding throughout the cycle, it's not uncommon for women to have spotting leading up to their period, but those situations are not optimal, and we should be looking at those. And, you know, one of the things about the period is that it's also very common for women to experience pain with their periods. And although it's common, again, I'm always here with my analogies. Imagine any man in your life who had such severe pain in his penis that for several days of the month, he maybe couldn't even go to work. No one would say that that's okay. You know, I think the only time that we think about pain as being kind of an acceptable part of a natural process would be childbirth. And so that's something that we should talk about. You know, while it's common for women to experience pain, you know, I delved into the research on periods. I wanted to have a really good understanding of what was happening there. And so a period is a normal inflammatory process by which we shed the functional layer of our endometrium. And so in order for that process to happen, there is a certain amount of inflammation that has to take place in order for this lining to be shed. And so from that perspective, when they compare women who have kind of moderate to severe period pain to women who are not, the women with the severe, you know, moderate to severe period pain are having upwards of 4 times the level of prostaglandins, which is an inflammatory marker. Mm-hmm. So just by looking at the research, I mean, if there's a difference between the women who don't have pain and the women who do have pain and they have higher inflammatory markers, then even just at the most basic level, period pain would be an indication of, you know, more significant inflammation in these women, mm-hmm. all the way up to a more severe condition like endometriosis, which is a really severe chronic debilitating issue. So back to like what's normal, I would say it's funny because sometimes I get pushback from saying that, you know, pain isn't normal in menstruation, because a lot of people say, well, it is normal. Mm-hmm. It's common. But I think, again, our body's trying to speak to us. And if we don't listen to the whispers, they become screams. Wow. So, you know, and a lot of women with moderate pain, where it's not so severe, can achieve a complete resolution of that by focusing on reducing inflammatory markers. Some women that have more severe and intense pain, it's going to be more of a process. Like you said, if it took all these years for this process to develop, it's not just immediately going to resolve overnight. But most women can experience some relief of their period pain. And that would indicate that it's a normal process going awry. So, mm-hmm. you know, and once, so to kind of keep this going, so I just talked about the period. So to kind of get into that first half of the menstrual cycle, signs of health, first of all, are that the cycle is ovulatory. And in order for the cycle to fall within that 24 to 35 day period, you know, ovulation has to happen somewhere between days 10 and about 22 or so. And so we would look at kind of the quality of that follicular phase. We would look at, you know, are you making cervical mucus? In a healthy cycle, we would expect 2 to 7 days of mucus. Are you having at least one day where you're making some of that clear, stretchy cervical fluid that looks like raw egg whites? And we could also look at your mood. How are you feeling? You know, what's going on? Once you've ovulated, then that's when your body starts to produce significant progesterone. And so in a healthy luteal phase, we would expect it to last about 12 to 14 days. And, you know, in a healthy luteal phase, you're producing significant progesterone, and it goes up and it peaks at mid-luteal if you don't conceive. And then it gradually, which is the key word, lowers. And then you get your period. And so one of the signs of hormonal imbalance, especially that we can see in the post-ovulatory phase, would be, you know, women who have a sharp drop in their progesterone where it's kind of stopped, like kind of coming down before it should be, that's associated with increased PMS symptoms. In really severe cases, PMDD, it's associated with that spotting that you see before your period. So there's a lot that we can gather just by paying attention to the cycle. And again, this is going back to that concept of the vital sign, where when you understand your cycle that way, then first of all, it demystifies a whole lot, mm-hmm. because now you kind of know what's going on. But you can really start to see, you know, how you can kind of tell if your hormones are balanced or if they're not. And it's a really, I think it's a really powerful way to kind of gauge your hormone health.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I feel like so many of us, at least I feel like in our generation, weren't raised with this education. Like, honestly, I'm 38, and only a few years ago did I come to realize, oh, I have 4 phases in my cycle. Yeah. How am I in my mid to late 30s and only just learning this information? And so I think this is a very empowering conversation that I'm so excited to share. Even if women have been familiar in tracking their cycles and aware of their phases, I think it's just a good reminder of just really tuning in with our bodies and using our menstrual cycle as this fifth vital sign, and not as something to like be annoyed by or to disregard. But when we really look at it as a marker of our health, it can be very empowering and very transformative.
And can I say one thing about that? Because, you know, I want to acknowledge, like, some women do have a really rough go at their menstrual cycle. Mm-hmm. So for some women, like, it is annoying. It is uncomfortable. Some women have really extreme pain and just a lot of different symptoms. And so, you know, I don't want to paint this picture that it's all rainbows and sunshine. But again, if we look at it as that this is your body's way of communicating to you, because I think the biggest issue in women who've had a lot of these negative experiences is that they really have to struggle to find answers. They really have to struggle many times to have a doctor take them seriously. the stats on endometriosis are just ridiculous. You know, on average, it takes a woman 8 to 12 years to get a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. There was this study that I kind of allude to in the endometriosis section. The study was a qualitative study. I always find it kind of fun when I find a qualitative study where they're actually talking to the people and hearing what they say. Anyways, so they called the study That One Doctor because it was a thing, this theme that kept coming up. They interviewed all these women who were ultimately diagnosed with endometriosis. And many of them, it had taken, you know, for a decade or, you know, to get someone to listen to them, they would always say, it was that one doctor who told me, have you heard of endometriosis? Or that one doctor who took them seriously and actually pushed them to get those additional testing. So I just want to kind of say that because it's hard. It's not easy. But if we reframe why you're having the symptoms, then it at least gives you some hope that you can find the answer.
100%. So Lisa, I know that you often speak to your custom protocols and obviously working directly with a woman and seeing how their cycle is speaking to them. Yet, do you have any general holistic recommendations for more of these unwanted or unwelcomed period symptoms, such as mood swings and period pain, which I know you mentioned lowering inflammation markers, or even hormonal acne? Would love to just hear your perspective on any holistic support that would be beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I know that you mentioned, like, one of the benefits about diving into the menstrual cycle is that we can really customize based on what's actually working for the cycle. But one of the things that I tend to like to focus on are what I often refer to as the foundational factors, because when we kind of start there, we can often reduce some of the symptoms or even just the intensity of them and really focus on what's happening. So, for example, many women undereat protein specifically and fat. And I know in Real Food for Fertility, there's a variety of places where we share just really interesting research on how, you know, the link between women who are under eating protein or fat specifically and how it can disrupt ovulatory function. So I think one of the most consistent themes that I've seen working with clients is that, you know, many of us are just, you know, inadvertently under eating. It could be an effect from the 90s, the focus on calories, and a lot of women are really concerned about weight loss, and that's a whole conversation about how to approach it. But I think the questions we have to ask in terms of balancing hormones and, you know, overcoming certain period issues, as you mentioned, for me, it always comes down to what is the most important thing for this client right now. Because if your biggest concern are those hormonal imbalances, or you're having really severe kind of PMS symptoms, even bordering into PMDD territory where it's having a negative impact on your days, if you're trying to conceive and you have really significant concerns about your cycle, then I think the first thing we need to do is really look at some of those foundational factors. So, you know, one of the things that we've already talked about is just the importance of getting enough protein. And again, you kind of brought up how many different diets there are, and now everyone has their own curated social media feed. Well, I didn't grow up with social media. You know, I graduated from high school in the year 2000, and so I didn't have a cell phone at all, and social media didn't come into play until far later. And now everybody's phone has a different curated feed, and so everybody has all of these different ideas about what it means to be healthy. And one of the things, I mean, I could take this in a lot of directions, but one of the things that I always kind of pick on is that a lot of us follow these male influencers who talk about these ideal ways to eat, but maybe aren't the best for the female body, right? And so in terms of, you know, those foundations, I would say, ideally, what we recommend is to have 3 meals a day to start your day with breakfast, so not to skip breakfast. So we could talk a little bit about the intermittent fasting influence if you want. But in order to support hormone function, what the research would indicate and what we found is that we want to really have that nutritional foundation. So 3 meals a day with sufficient protein, fat, and high quality carbohydrates. It sounds really simple. And I know sometimes you say that and people are like, woo, but it's not about what you know, it's about what you're doing. I mean, anyone who's listening, think about the last 7 days. How many days did you have breakfast? And when you did have breakfast, you know, did you have sufficient protein in that? And I mean, one of the ways to check if you had sufficient protein and fat in your breakfast was like how how long were you satiated? So, I mean, I grew up eating oatmeal every day for breakfast. I'm not anti-oatmeal, you know, but, you know, I had the experience of eating my oatmeal for breakfast and being hungry 30 minutes later. So, but when we're talking about supporting hormones, it's incredible what a difference that can make. Mm-hmm. There's even studies that show that women who eat breakfast have a lower risk for, you know, period pain, or there's studies that kind of link the breakfast aspect. There's stories that show, you know, women with PCOS who just start their day with a higher protein breakfast, mm-hmm. that it helps to normalize some of those cycle issues. So that would be one of the first things I would say. Let's look at the nutritional aspects. And you're not going to have balanced hormones if you're skipping meals. You're not going to have balanced hormones if you're just not eating enough. And we also have to look at your activity level. Because, again, you know, if I pause and talk a little bit about a stereotype. So stereotypically, a lot of men, when they're working out, they're trying to bulk up. So a lot of men, when they work out, are going to incorporate more protein or more calories. And women, stereotypically, we're often trying to lean up. So it doesn't even occur to us that we might need to eat more, even though we're moving our body more. And you see this in the cycle. So again, you know, what I typically see. So let's say, for example, you mentioned the hormonal acne and you mentioned the mood swings. So if I have a client that might be struggling with some of those issues, it's not uncommon, if we look at the menstrual cycle, to see that she's struggling with her luteal phase. And that could either be that it's too short, or it could be that she's seeing some spotting, or it could be that she just has some really heavy, intense PMS symptoms that are specifically around that time. And so before I jump into magical supplement territory and all of that stuff, there's a place for supplements, of course. We want to get those foundations really strong. So, you know, it sounds easy, it sounds simple, but it's not. Mm-hmm. And I can even jump into some of the very common trends and habits that we see. One of the kind of controversial things, and I think we were talking a little bit about this before we started recording, is the caffeine consumption, mm-hmm. right? So it's controversial, I would say, because it's very common, it's very acceptable, and people love their coffee, right? And again, if you drink your coffee every day and your cycle is totally fine and you have no hormonal issues, like no hormonal concerns, no fertility issues, then we don't have to talk about it. Like, mm-hmm. that's great. Do your thing. But when I'm working with clients, it's if we also have these hormonal imbalances, that we just should have a conversation so that you can be a little bit aware about how coffee or caffeine consumption could be contributing. Mm-hmm. And so one of the ways that I see caffeine contributing to hormonal imbalance is a bit of an indirect function, because if you are drinking coffee first thing in the morning and pushing breakfast till 10, 11, 12, whatever, then you need to be aware that caffeine is an appetite suppressant. So this is something that I've seen very, very consistently where, you know, you have a suspicion that your client is under eating because you're looking at their menstrual cycle and their food diary. And maybe they're either intentionally or unintentionally skipping breakfast, and coffee is not breakfast, for the record. And so, again, I've seen huge shifts where my clients are kind of like, they do the experiment, they cut out the coffee for a cycle, they end up sleeping better and all this stuff after the week of feeling horrible mm-hmm. from the coffee withdrawals. But what tends to happen is they naturally are all of a sudden hungry now mm-hmm. in the mornings. So that's a whole piece of it. We could talk about sleep quality. I mean, if you're not getting good quality sleep, your hormones won't be balanced. Mm-hmm. And then once we address, and there's others, I mean, obviously we touched on xenoestrogen exposure, chemical exposure. So, you know, that would be one of the foundational factors as well, really looking at your products and your exposures, minimizing pesticides, all of those kinds of things, especially as it relates to fertility. There were some really interesting studies on male fertility. So the studies often show a positive effect for men eating leafy greens and high antioxidant foods and also citrus fruits because of the high antioxidant quality. But the studies where the men are eating pesticide-laden leafy greens as opposed to organic show a specific benefit to eating organic to reduce the pesticides. So, you know, there's a lot of these different foundational aspects that we want to focus on. And then once we have that in line, what's really interesting is you often see a general overall improvement.
Absolutely.
In mood, in all of these things. And then if you still have some of those lingering symptoms, like if it brings you 60% of the way there or 80% of the way there, then we can look at introducing some key supplements. and looking deeper to see if there's other contributing factors. Like for the acne piece, maybe we need to look at, you know, there's some studies that show that zinc supports, right, normal, like reducing acne, and obviously looking at gut health and different factors. And, you know, with PMS symptoms, boosting progesterone further, focusing on magnesium, focusing on key nutrients, even vitamin C has been shown to support progesterone production, luteal phase. But what I always go back to is that if you start with the supplements without addressing the foundations, you may get some benefit, but you're not going to get the full benefit. If you start with the foundations and then use supplements, the hint is in the word supplement. You're supposed to supplement what you're doing. And if you have the nutritional foundations, if you are improving the micronutrient intake as well as getting sufficient macros. So the macronutrients, the protein, the fat, the carbohydrates, we need that. Those are the building blocks that we need in order to make hormones, in order to normalize all of this. The micronutrients are what we need to make everything function properly. It's what we need to optimize the egg quality. It's what we need for all of these different functions in the body. So that's the foundation. And then we can add supplements. Mm-hmm. And truly, what I've found is that that's when you really see the best overall result. And so it does take time and work and effort. Mm-hmm. I can sit here and talk about, oh, just eat breakfast, whatever. But a lot of my clients are super busy. And we spend a ton of time strategizing around, well, what can that look like? What are some of the options? You know, you're super busy. How can you organize this? Like, can you plan what you're going to have on hand in your office? So a lot of it is the practical. I hear what you're saying, but I don't have time to X, Y, Z. How can I do this and make this a real part of my life on a regular basis?
Mm-hmm. Do you have any practical tips to help busy woman, busy mama to actually put these into practice?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is that it depends on what your life looks like, and it also depends on how much of a priority it is for you. So one thing I know for sure is that no one has time. I mean, what woman do you know over the age of 20 that just sits around all day and has all this time? Regardless of whether you have children yourself or whether you have a family, you have friends, you have nieces, nephews, you have a job, you have, right? Like all of us are busy. None of us have time. So the first thing is, like, we just have to acknowledge that there's not going to be this like sky opening, like time that's just going to open up for you. You have to decide that it's important. Mm. And then the second part of it is you have to kind of look at the reality of your mornings or your evenings and think, like, what is doable? So, you know, some of my clients over the years, they'll do a shake, and that'll be the way for them to get it in. Some of my clients will do leftovers. So leftovers are a wonderful option for breakfast because you can get in your protein. And I think it also shifts, like, who decided that breakfast was like a croissant and a bagel? I mean, I always, from a practical standpoint, even if we're not, like, can we just pause from the nutritional benefit? Can we just talk about the practical aspect? I'm a busy woman. I'm like, there's all kinds of stuff going on. I don't have time to be hungry, hangry all the time. I don't have time to be, right? Like, we have to think about breakfast as an actual meal.
Yeah.
And I think that is really helpful. So, and that helps us to get out of thinking that it has to look a certain way. So if you made soup the night before, you could have a little bit of that with a little bit of the protein that you had. So we have to be creative. A lot of my clients will do eggs. They'll, you know, boil a bunch of eggs and have them like hard-boiled egg or soft-boiled egg or whatever. So, you know, and I'm sure that in the show notes page, I mean, there's art, like Lily has some great, great articles with, I think she literally just released an article with like 25 breakfast ideas and half of them aren't eggs. So for people that don't necessarily want eggs, right? So there's a lot of different things that you can do. I think the best thing, I can't sit here and say this is what's going to work best for everybody, but I've shared some ideas that I'm sure have sparked some kind of ideas for everyone who's listening. Mm-hmm. And I feel like just take 10 minutes and write down, you know, five things that could work for you. Mm-hmm. And they don't need to be perfect. You don't have to take a picture of it and put it on Pinterest. It just has to work. And ideally, it would have sufficient protein and be balanced. Balanced macronutrients, protein, fat, and some carbohydrates. Mm-hmm.
I love that because I feel like, too, when we prioritize that breakfast and these habits and practices that you've suggested and mentioned, I feel like it actually allows us to be more productive during the day.
Yeah.
And I feel like it just saves time because then we're not scrounging for snacks or whatever we can find. And then we feel pretty terrible come mid-afternoon. Like, I feel like this is actually setting us up for success, to feel better, to show up better, and just, live a more vibrant life.
One other thing that came to mind, I mean, I was focusing on breakfast, but, you know, strategizing with clients over the years, it's lunchtime. The question is like, do you have anything on hand? Like, do you have anything for when the days don't go perfect? Because also we have to recognize that every day isn't going to be perfect. And sometimes you're going to literally have to fly out the house and you won't have time. So sometimes it can be helpful to think, okay, so should I buy some beef jerky? Should I buy like some cheese and put it in my fridge in the office? Like, are there other things you can do to kind of plan so that you have, just to make it easier for yourself in the moment? And again, it doesn't have to be perfect. This is a process. You just want to start somewhere and you'll see what works and what doesn't work. And gradually it'll become easier.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Okay, Lisa, as we kind of close out our convo today, I feel like a lot of our listeners are mamas with their own little girls or little boys, and I know you have three of your own. I would love just for you to share how you are raising up your children with this awareness of their bodies, or what you plan to put in place with your daughter, and how can moms in our community start to educate their children on this whole conversation that we've been talking about today?
Oh, I love that question. It's so funny because my son's already. So how about I share this one story with you? Because I think it's funny and then we'll get into it. So when I started, well, back in the day, there's a company and they make this product called the Wondrous Vulva Puppet.
What is it called?
Wondrous Vulva Puppet.
Okay, cool.
So they make these teaching tools where it's, and so look it up, you'll find it. I'm not affiliated with them, so this is just like just me saying it. But they have these like full size like pillow type vulvas that you can use for training purposes and like to educate and things like that. And I've wanted one for such a long time, but I didn't get one. And this Christmas, I was like, you know what? It's my 10-year anniversary for my podcast. I'm gonna get myself a vulva puppet. So it comes in the mail.
And your son finds it first.
And I open it out and my eldest is like, what is that? And of course I'm like, it's a vulva. And he's just like, Mom.
That is so funny.
So I feel like that's a good entrance into the
Yes. Okay. Everyone just buy this Wondrous Vulva Puppet and start the conversation.
Yeah. So the reason that I bring up the vulva puppet example is just to illustrate that one of the ways that I'm raising my children is by being open about the body parts and talking about them using the correct terminology and answering questions as they come up. And let me tell you, even last week, there were some very interesting questions that my eldest has been asking now, because of course he's just about to be in junior high, and even questions that make me uncomfortable, even though I'm quite comfortable talking about all of these topics. But I just have made this commitment to myself that when the questions come up, I need to answer them. And you answer them in a way that's age appropriate. And I do my best to educate. And so, for example, you know, my eldest son is in grade 7. And this is the age, like he's 12. And so this is the age when girls start to get their periods. So we had a whole conversation about, we've had many, but one of the conversations we've had about periods is for them to understand what it is and, you know, for them to know that it's normal and natural. And, you know, I'm the kind of mom that was like, okay, so you know about periods, and it's difficult sometimes for girls to navigate this in those early years. And so if you ever have a girl in your class where you see a little something, you're going to be the mature one who doesn't laugh at her. You're going to be the one that's like, periods are normal. And, you know, so, you know, that's kind of tongue in cheek. That's kind of my style. But I would say that it's not one conversation. It's conversations that happen on a regular basis. They know a little bit about what I do. My youngest son, I feel like, because of course in my house, words like cervical mucus and all kinds of stuff are all the time. And he's like, you know, what's that? And like, ew, right? Because he's 9. But it's just, they, whether they like it or not, they are around this all the time. And I know that it's really going to benefit them. Mm-hmm. And as for my daughter, I mean, she's 2.5. So we have a little ways to go. And one of the things is that I've been in the field long enough to have seen what happens, even for women like myself who have a lot of knowledge around it. So sometimes, depending on your daughter, you might think, oh, I'm going to do all this stuff and throw her period party. And like, she's mortified and she wants you to not be like that. And she might even try to hide when she gets her period because she doesn't want her mommy to throw her. Like, so I think with all of that kind of experience that I've seen, I plan to kind of take the same approach of being open, being honest, providing information. And I mean, I hope that she'll be open to it. But I also remember, like, those years are a little bit awkward. Your whole body is changing. Things, so much is out of your control. Mm-hmm. You just, like, I mean, at least with the charting aspect of it, you can predict your period. But that's something where a lot of girls, it's so out of their control. Like, for some girls, that's why they go on the pill, because they don't want to be surprised and they don't want to, you know, to get their period too soon. And I think for women who are listening who have young girls, one of the ways I think that can be really helpful to talk about the cycle is to talk about it in a positive way, to share about the different phases of the cycle, like we touched on, and to talk about how your energy and mood can be different and to normalize that. So one of my favorite ways to talk about the cycle is inspired by the work of Alexander Pope and Shawnee Hugo Wurlitzer. They wrote the book called Wild Power. And in that book, they talk about the seasons of the menstrual cycle and liken it to the seasons of the year. And so, you know, your pre-ovulatory phase when you're leading up to ovulation is like the inner spring. Because if you think about it, I mean, your follicles developing, your ovaries to ovulate, that's very much like fruit trees flowering and, you know, the fruit preparing for ripening. And then ovulation is like the inner summer. And, you know, every woman isn't the same, but generally speaking, a lot of women feel a lot of that creative energy in that spring phase and the summer energy when, you know, they feel more outgoing. So generally speaking, a lot of women resonate with that. Once ovulation takes place, you're kind of moving into the autumn, like the fall. Mm-hmm. And so that the burst of that summer energy is kind of coming to a close and we're kind of moving into the winter. Mm-hmm. So for some of us, we don't want to do as much of the outgoing work, or maybe, you know, and it kind of explains, I think, for a lot of women why they might feel a certain way. They might feel mm-hmm. hard on themselves because maybe they don't feel as energized in these other phases as they do in the summer phase. And they might feel bad about that because the expectations that we're always supposed to be on. But understanding the shifts can be really helpful. And then, of course, the winter would be when you're on your period. And so it can kind of give you permission not to, not to want to run a marathon when you're actively bleeding. And some of us need that permission. But going back to talking to our daughters about this, this can be really helpful for them to feel like they have some control and some agency and to help them better understand the different changes that they're going through. And I also think that cervical mucus is a great thing to talk about with young girls, because again, if you don't talk about it, it could just be this gross stuff that's on your panties, right? And the concept of vaginal discharge, and it can feel very yucky if no one explains to you mm-hmm. that actually this is a really good sign of health. When you're making mucus, it means your hormones are healthy. It means you can know when you're ovulating. And it also means you can predict when your period is coming, because literally just by tracking when you have mucus and when you have it and when it stops, your luteal phase, when you're healthy, is kind of stable, kind of constant. And so you can have a good idea when your period is coming just by tracking that. So I feel like those are some, some practical ways you can talk to your daughters about it. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, I get the question sometimes about, you know, when do you think we should teach fertility awareness to our daughters? And I think that there's a way to bring cycle awareness without going straight into sex and contraception. I think we mm-hmm. can bring that cycle awareness first. And then when it's appropriate, we can certainly talk about the more contraceptive or conception aspects of it. So, mm-hmm. so much we can do.
I feel like that's so valuable. And I know, again, as I mentioned, I was 35 when I learned we had phases, and just learning more about my body and my cycle. So I think it's so empowering to be able to raise up this next generation to have that awareness earlier on. So thanks for sharing. So Lisa, from your perspective, why do you think that our modern healthcare system really shuts down women when they come in with these imbalances and symptoms, rather than wanting to truly help them find a cure for the cause of these, really just wanting to put this kind of band-aid on their symptoms?
I mean, I think that there's a couple of reasons. I think first and foremost, we have to understand what our kind of traditional medical system is. So we have to kind of understand the concept of allopathic medicine, which is essentially that the foundation of our contemporary medical system. And it's quite literally a pill for every ill. The modern medical system, and I know some people might disagree if I say this, but ultimately it is symptom management. So although today we're highlighting some of the issues with women's health in particular, this is a theme in all areas of health. I mean, if your blood pressure is high, you're given a pill. If your cholesterol is high, you're given a pill. At the end of the day, this is what our medical system is. So I think the first step is actually acknowledging what it is. So because I've been in this field for a long time, maybe I've gone through all the stages of grief, you know, I don't know. But when the problem comes when you expect something different. So I think one of the big challenges is that when women learn about this information and they learn about their cycle and they start charting their cycle, it's like they expect their daughters to, or doctors to throw a party or something. So then they go to the doctor's office and, you know, they bring their charts and, you know, look at what I'm doing. First of all, the doctor didn't learn in medical school how to read a fertility awareness chart unless they specifically took an elective that would allow them to do that. So if someone brought me an EKG and was like, oh, you know, read, tell me about my EKG, I would have to say, I'm not a medical doctor. I don't know how to read an EKG. But certainly you can go to your doctor to read it. So I think we have to first have a clear expectation. And again, I love teaching with analogies. So just imagine if I went to, what's a good example? If I went to Walmart and I'm like at the teller, like the regular cashier, and I'm yelling at her because I want her to change the tires on my car. So someone would videotape me and put me on TikTok and be like, what is wrong with this person? So obviously, if I want someone to change the tires on my car, I need to go somewhere where that's what they do there. And so I think the first thing is that we really have to understand as women what our medical system is. And we have to learn about how doctors are trained. And, you know, on my podcast, I've had the pleasure of interviewing many doctors. And when I would interview doctors, especially years ago, like I had this question too. I was like, well, what's going on? What are you being taught in med school? Tell me about it. And so overwhelmingly, when I interview doctors, what they tell me is that in medical school, first of all, they're not taught about, like, they're of course taught about the physiology and anatomy, but they're not taught about the fertility awareness method. And literally they are taught that when there are cycle irregularities, the pill is the, like, that's what they're taught. I think having just understanding that that is where they're coming from, and that is what their knowledge base is, and that is how they're taught, it helps us to understand. So then the question is, can you really blame them? Because their modality isn't designed to be looking at the root cause. Mm-hmm. And so that's difficult, because then it puts the pressure and responsibility back on you if you don't want to be put on the pill, if you don't want that approach, then you may have to then consider putting a care team together. So the way I always talk about it is I call it my boardroom analogy, where, you know, you are at this, the head of the table and you have your doctor there. But if you decide that I want to prioritize my hormone health, I want to optimize my nutrition, I want to learn how to track my cycle, then in addition to your primary care doctor, you might also need to have a nutritionist. You might also need to have a holistic coach or a fertility awareness coach. You might have to have more people on your team to actually address your needs in the way you want to. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I don't know, you can just bang your head against a wall if you just spend all your time being upset with doctors. We have to learn about what they do. We have to, you know, we need doctors. I've had clients who are so anti-establishment that they proudly say, like, I haven't seen a doctor in 10 years. And I'm like, I don't know if that's the way to go. I feel like we have to just acknowledge what it is that they do and then find a way to really navigate and get our needs met. And sometimes people need to hear that your doctor was trained in medical school in a certain way, mm-hmm. and they don't know everything. Doctors that I've interviewed, they tell me that they get like an afternoon of nutrition. So if you want, like, in the whole, however many years that they do it. So your doctor is not your nutritionist, unless they also have that certification. They're not your fertility awareness coach. they're not your, you know, you have to kind of, and if you want a doctor that specializes in root cause medicine, then you want to find an MD that has trained in that functional medicine mm-hmm. approach, right? So we have to start being a little bit more critical about mm-hmm. who we're seeking care from.
It's so good. I think that's such a great reframe and like setting that expectation of going to someone who is trained in that yeah. modality and putting together your care team. I love that. It takes a village in every way. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today. I feel like this conversation was insanely insightful. And I'm personally super grateful because I'm getting married this year. And this fertility conversation is very relevant. And really excited to dig into your book and just learn more in a very specific way in this season. And I know our community of mamas and women and men are going to have so many takeaways from our conversation. Could you tell our listeners where they can learn more about what you do, your work, and just to follow along with your journey?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, thank you for having me. This was so much fun. It just has been a great experience, and it was really nice to get to meet you. And you can find out more about what I do. I mean, I'm on Instagram at Fertility Friday, so I hang out there. I have my podcast, the Fertility Friday podcast. We just celebrated our 10-year anniversary, which is wild. Amazing. So there's over 500 episodes to dig into. So, I mean, you can just type Fertility Friday into your favorite podcast player. And there's another organization that took Fertility Friday as well. So I'm the pink one.
Oh, okay.
So when you search, so you'll see a lot of pink and then you'll know that it's me.
Just like your book.
Just like the book.
Fifth Vital Sign.
So my first book, The Fifth Vital Sign, my second book is the Fertility Awareness Mastery Charting Workbook. So I had a paper charting workbook that I made, and Real Food for Fertility just came out last year. So lots of great content to dig into. If you're wanting to kind of just get a sneak peek, you can get the first chapter of Real Food for Fertility for free over at realfoodforfertility.com. And just some fun facts about this book. I mean, we surveyed just thousands of papers in the writing of the book, and we've cited over 2,500 citations. And so when we were deciding on printing, we had to decide what we were going to do about all these citations. If we'd included the citations in the actual book itself, it would have been 700 pages instead of 400 pages. So fun fact, you know, if you're reading the book and you're wanting to grab those citations, you know, you can find more information on our website, because we actually had to put them separately as a PDF download.
Amazing.
So all this is to say that, you know, what I've realized is one of the reasons why people gravitate to my work and Lily's work is because we spend a lot of time reading all of these complex research papers, and we just have a knack for distilling that information in a really accessible form. Mm-hmm. So even though it has enough data for it to be like a textbook, you know, it doesn't feel like that when you're reading it.
Yes, I've so appreciated your analogies and really breaking down sometimes more complex concepts. And so I feel like you've just been overflowing so naturally all the information and wisdom you hold within you. So thank you so much.
Thanks again.